have that first responders breakfast tomorrow. We will be broadcasting live from Scramblers. Friday Roadshow, new Friday Roadshow sponsored. Custom shade residential, commercial, and auto window tinting powered by 3M Window Film. All right. These are the same folks that Springfield Wraps and everything do the studio. They're very good at what they do, and custom shade window tinting is one of those things. And so now, what's that?
I said, where's their shop located? Do you know off the top of your head?
You know, I actually saw the address earlier, but I don't remember.
I need some window tinting done.
Oh, well.
Yeah. I know.
Womack can hook you up.
I know. I'm excited about it.
On your home or your car?
On my car.
Okay, yeah. No, they'll do that. They'll do that. So they're the sponsor of the Friday Roadshow. And then it is a first responders breakfast tomorrow. So if you are a first responder, and that includes dispatch, 911 operators, you know, all you folks, then we'd love for you to join us as Scramblers, Pyramid Roofing Company, Barker's Frame and Collision, buy you breakfast 6, 8 to 9, 8 tomorrow. ABC Books North Glenstone, our sponsor of Author of the Week. And this is sort of a... I think the background on how to describe this. Now, Adam Pitluck, he is the author of the week, and this isn't a traditional author booking, if you will. It came about because of, among other reasons, if I'm correct, you were fraternity brothers with a guy that I graduated with, Ben Stroman, right? Is that correct?
That's right. Carthage High School, class of 95.
Yeah, so you are, just to give some, if you would give background, I know you're a journalist, but give a little bio or auto bio of yourself, if you would, for folks.
Sure. I am a journalist. I worked for Time Magazine for about 7.5 years and People Magazine. Also from my days in New York, I was the editor-in-chief, I think my biggest platform, I was the editor-in-chief of American Airlines and Flight Magazine American Way for about a decade. And these days, I'm a college professor teaching journalism.
And I think just on the spectrum, not that this really should be relevant, but you seem to be a little more objective than I think people stereotype many journalists, accurately so in this country. The book that you have is actually a book that's been out for some time, for those of you listening. It's Damned to Eternity, the story of the man who they said caused the flood. Now, usually the books that we speak about with the authors are new releases, but this is relevant to something that is going on today. And this is sort of how I became aware of it, because Ben had reached out to me on this particular issue involving one James Scott, who essentially was accused of and is imprisoned because of these accusations that he essentially was responsible for the entire flooding of a town. And this goes back to what many people remember back in the 90s, 93, the floods that were taking place. I remember, as I was a kid at the time, and driving through parts of the country that were impacted by this with my dad, and towns, people, sandbags were being put up in anticipation of the massive rise of the river. And one of those towns was West Quincy, Illinois. And so with all that setup being said, if you would, tell the story that Damned to Eternity is about.
Yes, and thanks for pointing out the objectivity point with the journalism, because I did write this book straight up, trying to be as fair and balanced as possible. It's only over the years, as more evidence was uncovered, that I completely did an about face, and I think that he's not only 100% innocent, I think it was railroaded. And this might be one of the earlier cases of lawfare, you know, which is right, quite apropos considering we're in that space in America right now. The story was this. This was the biggest flood in American history at the time, bigger than Johnstown, which was man-made in 100 years earlier. In the summer of 1993, the Mississippi River was well over its flood stage, and not just in Missouri. This is all the way from southern Minnesota, northern Iowa, all the way down into Arkansas. There were something like 13 or 14 levee breaks happening in succession all the way down the Mississippi River. the town of West Quincy, Missouri, which is right across the Mississippi from Quincy, Illinois, was the next in line. All the levees upriver had broken, and this one was next. So the call went out for everybody in the community in Quincy and West Quincy, and then in neighboring Hannibal, to come down to the river and sandbag. There wasn't enough manpower for the government or the river drainage districts to do it alone. So everybody came down. One of the people that came down when they heard the call was James Scott, who was a local bad boy. He was 21 at the time. He'd been notorious in town because he and his brothers, when they were 11, 12 and 13 respectively, burnt down an old historic abandoned school called Webster Elementary School in Quincy. So by all accounts, James Scott was not a model citizen, but at the same time, he was a nonviolent juvenile offender. He went down to sandbag the levee with everybody else, and that night the levee broke. Just by sheer circumstance, he was walking down from the levee where he had been working earlier, where he was flagged to do a man on the street interview by a local reporter. And the second he went on TV saying that he was down there sandbagging and trying to help the community, across the river in Quincy, Illinois, two detectives, brothers, were watching the live newscast, immediately called each other and said, there's something wrong with this story. There's no way he was there helping. He was there causing harm. They automatically jumped to that conclusion. And long story short, he became the only man in American history to be arrested, charged, tried, convicted, and sentenced for intentionally causing a catastrophe. It's also important to note that nobody died in this flood. Nobody was even injured, but he received a life sentence, and he's still there now.
All right. That being said, as we our author of the week, Adam Whitluck, the book is Damned to Eternity. I want to take just 90-second break here and continue on with the author of the week and this story and why it is relevant today. Sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, I'm Nick Reed. Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. Adam Pitluck is with us. He's journalist and author. The book is Damned to Eternity, the story of the man who they said caused the flood. And if you've missed any of the discussion so far, of course, we will have this up in podcast section, ksgf.com, and variation of other places as well. You laid out the groundwork of the history here, and this is the Great Midwestern Floods of 93, and like so many other towns, West Quincy, Illinois, had people volunteering, helping people in the community, sandbagging, and it did not hold. It did not hold, unfortunately, the sandbags, as was the case in a number of communities in this tremendous flood, and one of the volunteers was 24-year-old James Scott, who was known to local law enforcement, rabble-rouse, or so forth, never had done anything criminally speaking that was physically harmful to anyone. Given some background here, what you talked about for the listeners that are just tuning in, after that levee broke, James Scott happened to be the first one to walk by a local reporter. Local reporter interviewed him, and these cops who were familiar with him from Quincy, Illinois, or West Quincy, thought, well, that's that troublemaker there. He must have had something to do with causing this flood. Is that a fair nutshell of what we know so far?
Yeah, that's spot on.
Okay, so then what happens?
Two things are happening simultaneously, but unbeknownst to each other. So first things first, about a month after the flood, the civilian chair of the levee drainage district in that area, a guy named Norman Hare, he very quietly went to Washington, D.C. and testified before Congress. This is not even a full month after the flood. Testified before Congress along with other commissioners of other drainage districts in the up and down the Mississippi River that the Army Corps of Engineers was basically negligent in maintaining this levee, not just for the floods of 93, but generationally. Most of the farmers in this area are good, hardworking people, and they're generational. So they farm the lands that their daddies farmed and their daddy granddaddies and so forth. And that was the case with Norman Hare, with this guy. However, he went in front of Congress and just lambasted the Corps of Engineers, saying that as the civilian drainage district chair, all he thought he was supposed to do is mow the levee, check for groundhogs, and, mm-hmm. and basically just report any problems. The Corps of Engineer completely tasked him with its maintenance, of which case, for it to fail, he's kind of left holding the bag. Mm-hmm. While that's happening, back in Missouri, law enforcement from Illinois that doesn't even have jurisdiction is investigating what's purported to be a Missouri crime and the case of James Scott. There's no evidence, zero. Yet they haul James Scott into Illinois, basically concoct some other cases they want to ask him about, other crimes, to give a fair and legal explanation to bring him in. And then they hit him with the levee. James Scott admitted to moving 4 sandbags on the levee, which is why he was there in the first place, was to sandbag. They told him that caused the levee to break. His reply was along the lines of, well, I didn't mean to make it worse. And they said that was a confession. Literally, that's the trial transcript. They said that was a confession. So on the one hand, you have the guy charged with maintaining the levee testifying before Congress that it was the Corps of Engineers' fault. While back home in Missouri, Illinois cops are building a case against this one guy, James Scott. So this is less than a month after the levee break. Fast forward to October. So now we're about 3 months after the levee break. James Scott's charged with breaking the levee. And when it goes to trial, Norman Hare, the same guy that testified before Congress that it was the Corps of Engineers' fault, did a complete about-face and now testified that the levee was rock solid and it would have held were it not for James Scott being there and causing the levee to break. So you have this tremendous conspiracy of which we uncovered over decades of research why they actually came to need a scapegoat.
We're talking with our author of the week, Adam Pitluck. The book is Damned to Eternity, and the book came out some time ago, but this is... And we're going to get here in an upcoming segment the relevance of this today. And we are, in the meantime, going to get a traffic update, quick break. We have weather as well, and then we will continue on. Generally, listeners know that generally Author of the Week is wrapped up by now, but this is we're going to do another segment or two here with Adam Pitluck and maybe even have some subsequent discussions about this very issue, because those of you who know me know I've talked about just, I wouldn't say it's an obsession, but I always have a great interest and concern of people that are serving prison time that arguably evidence demonstrates should not be. And this is, I think you'll find reading the book and listening to the additional information Adam is going to provide to us, the case here. So more of that ahead. I'm Nick Reed, Springfield's Talk 104.1. First alert forecast sponsored by St. Clair of the Ozarks Home Improvements from Color 10 Fox 49 meteorologist Tom Schmidt. Sunshine, high near 74 today, 50 tonight. Mostly sunny with a high near 69 tomorrow. Saturday, sunny, high near 74. We are talking with author Adam Pitluck. The book is Damned to Eternity. And the book is the time frame, 90s, 93, Great Midwestern Floods. James Scott, sort of a rabble-rouser, if you will, known to local law enforcement, not a violent guy by any stretch, was helping with other citizens in the area sandbag to try to prevent levee breaches from occurring during the flood. And the breach did occur. He happened to be the first person that walked by a local reporter doing a story, and he, you know, did a little man-on-the-street interview. Law enforcement that was familiar with him said he must have something to do with this. They're from Quincy, Illinois, yet they do an investigation in Missouri on him in which they don't have jurisdiction, and essentially pin the entire levee breach on him. And that's where we are in the story. Adam Pitluck, take it from there, if you would.
Great. Thank you very much, Nick. So the overlying question then becomes why? Why pin it on this guy? Is there any other than they don't like him?
Right.
Why go to these lengths to essentially violate the law by overstepping jurisdictional boundaries and going forward with this trial? So here's what we uncovered. A couple things. Number one, if you're farming the land on the river bottoms, the land not just on the Mississippi River, but on the Missouri River or the Raccoon River up in Iowa, any farmers that farm the lands and live in the river bottoms, they need to have federal flood insurance through FEMA, to cover a flood, because acts of God, force majeure, is not covered in a homeowner's policy when it comes to the river flooding. It's like if you live in a hurricane zone, you have to have special flood insurance or hurricane insurance in order to cover that. So these sorts of catastrophes, the federal government needs to insure you, FEMA, or you won't be made whole. None of these farmers had federal flood insurance, in part because they were generational farmers, good, hardworking farmers. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking anything away from them.
Right.
But this was the 500-year flood. There's no precedent for this. They didn't need it in the past. Why would they need it now? So they didn't have the federal flood insurance. The only way they could be made whole when their crops washed out and when their houses washed out is if somebody vandalized the levee. So vandalism was covered as their part of their homeowner's insurance policy. So that's part one. When you follow the money, that's where it leads. Part two is this. The story changed two different times. I think once they went down the rabbit hole where you needed to have a scapegoat to collect on a flood insurance claim, they had that. They got their conviction. In 1994, when this case went to trial, they got a conviction. The problem is James Scott, using the public defender, because he's the working poor from Quincy, Illinois, the public defender even flagged the fact that the prosecution just violated jurisprudence. They played fast and loose with the rules, violated policy, introduced evidence and witnesses without declaring it or giving the defense opportunity, no discovery. So even though he was given a life sentence and convicted, the evidence being completely circumstantial, they said that he dug into the levee with a shovel or a dynamite, because they say that's the only way you could really, you can't just break a levee. Keep in mind, bulldozers were driving up and down this thing. Army National Guard and civilians were walking up and down this thing. And there's, so for one person to actually break the levee, they said they had to either blow it up or dig into it for prolonged periods of time. Once that case was, he got a life sentence, but then 5 years later, he was granted a new trial because of the prosecution's misconduct. Story changed. Now they said, for the second trial, that he broke the levee by moving sandbags with a motive. And the motive was this. A 16-year-old kid was under house arrest at the time. And the Illinois police, when they interviewed him, said basically, we'll get you off house arrest for this testimony. The 16-year-old kid testified that James Scott set at a party. He broke the levee to strand his wife in Missouri so he can party in Illinois without her. And that case made headlines. That
right.
Put this forest square in the national news. Court TV came down and did the second trial. And the second trial was moved to Hannibal, which was flooding at the time. And same result as the first, life sentence.
They're also in, if you could touch on here, and I don't want to go too much into this because, of course, the book. And then there's also a really great mini documentary that we'll post. I think it's 20 minutes, 25 minutes or so that does a good job of really giving some of the aspects of this that indicate clearly something is not right. That one of you can clarify this. What one of the individuals that was relied on as an expert witness against him in some capacity also benefited by getting insurance money if he was convicted. Is that correct?
I'm a little so the let me take one step back.
Yeah.
Norman Hare, who I mentioned in the first segment, the farmer tasked, or the civilian chair of the drainage district that was tasked with maintaining the levee, mowing it, tasked by the Corps of Engineers, the guy that testified before Congress, who then blaming the Corps of Engineers, but then flip-flop at trial, saying the levee was rock solid, it was only for James Scott, is one farmer that received, not only did he receive an insurance payout because the levee was deemed to have been vandalized rather than an act of God, but when he testified at trial, he did not disclose that he had a financial stake in the outcome of that trial. So the key witness for the prosecution had a financial stake in the outcome and never disclosed it.
We're talking with our author of the week, Adam Pitluck, the book Damned to Eternity. Going to take a 90-second break. When we come back, wrap up with you why this is relevant today. And I say wrap up with you today. That doesn't mean that we may not have you, or we may have you, rather, back in the future as for reasons that the next segment may explain. And I know I'm already working on getting some other people who are involved in this case in studio to talk about some other aspects of this as well. So more with Adam Pitluck in just moments. I'm Nick Reed. Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. Adam Pitluck, the book Damned to Eternity, the story of the man who they said caused the flood. Any of it that you missed, I recommend you go back, listen to on the podcast. This is something that we will, and already setting up with some other folks, other aspects of this case, which, though the book came out some time ago, is relevant today. And the reason for that, Adam, I'll have you explain now, if you would.
Absolutely. And let me just put one disclaimer on this. The book is currently out of print. I mean, you could still get it at the library. You can get it third party. I bring that up because there's no financial stake in this for me at all.
Right.
It's now a crusade. This is just a crusade to right what was put wrong. Here's why it makes sense to this day. And I should mention that I've known James Scott now since I was a junior studying journalism at the University of Missouri. I was working for the newspaper in Columbia, Missouri. That's how I came to know about this case. He was going through his second trial at the time. So I've now known James Scott since 1998. And I've been following this case since 1998. So I put enough work in there where we've uncovered, he was convicted on circumstantial evidence. We've uncovered many more circumstances pointing to his innocence. The reason this is important today is because this is the first case of lawfare, I think, in Missouri that you could actually point to and measure empirically. If you look back through the times in the 1990s when Mel Carnahan was the Democratic governor and all the law enforcement, all the prosecutors he was working with in Missouri were also Democrats. This is literally a case of we got to get this guy because we got to make everybody whole for this disaster mm-hmm. that they basically just weren't prepared for. After they got the conviction now, he's been in prison for over 30 years. He's not only in the prison, he's in a level 5 maximum security. So for 30 years, he's been in the same prison with the murderers, rapists, child molesters for a nonviolent property damage crime. He hasn't had a parole hearing yet. He was supposed to have two different ones, and they keep moving the date, and they won't tell him why. And I can't even figure out why. Every time I try to get the correspondence from the 90s between Governor Mel Carnahan and who was at the time Tom Reddington, the prosecuting attorney in Marion County, who's now the second district judge in Knox County, Missouri, I can't get any response for any of these FOIA correspondences or emails. One of the excuses I got from the Marion County Courthouse was that, ironically, there was a big flood there, not from 93, but years later, and all their records were destroyed. So there's still something rotten in Denmark here that we just can't put our finger on because there's zero evidence to convict this guy.
And for people that, why, especially if you read through the book, and also we'll post, it's Vice that had that documentary that gives some real highlights and just shows you that there's clearly some issue here and why you can't even get anyone to look at it. And given he has already those parole dates, they keep moving them without explanation. You think, well, what would be the motivation here for keeping him there? And I guess potentially if it went a certain way, you would have all this insurance money paid out that should not have been paid out. And there could be implications for that, correct?
I think there could be implications for that. I think there could also be political implications. This case is so old that it started in the pre-internet days, when the email started going during the second trial in 1998. That was at the infancy of email and the web. So I don't think anybody envisioned back then, of course, that there would be this technology and connectivity boom where we could find all this stuff. So I think part of the reason they have to keep them locked up is to save face. I mean, we're uncovering all of their fast and loose procedural errors, and it's easier to just keep it suppressed versus, you know, letting him out. I mean, there's literally no reason. This, not only has he been in prison for over 30 years, he has an exemplary prison record for being in a level five. I mean, you can't really get college degrees and certificates because it's a level five maximum security. They don't give you those opportunities when you're serving life. But talking to any of the guards or the majors or anyone at the prison that have known him for decades, they say he's a model inmate. And yet he's going to die in prison.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that it's been suggested, even to him, that particularly with the parole, though they keep trying, seemingly they're moving that around, but that if he would just say, oh yeah, I did it, I'm really sorry, that he would in all likelihood be let out. But he is one of these individuals that said, I will not do that, I didn't do it, and even if that means spending the rest of my life in prison, I did not do it, and I will not confess to something that I did. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. That's 100% accurate. And what's more, the reason he's taking this moral posture now is because he has admitted in the book as well, over the years, to every crime he's done, including some of the ones that didn't even catch, some of the petty vandalisms and burglaries he did. He's admitting to everything. He won't admit to this. Since he's been locked up, he's lost everything. Both of his parents passed away since he's been locked up. One of his brothers passed away since he's been locked up. Like, he has nothing. He's not going to be released to this new world with a guilty conscience. Like, he's become religious inside. Like, this is his way. This was his penitence. He feels he's paid all that time and then some for all his past transgressions. So he says when he comes out, he wants to come out a free man. He's not going to just cop to anything just to play lip service to a parole board that gets 31 years later.
And it is crazy in the larger context of what we see today, these stories of people that commit straight-up murder, and they will spend 15, 20 years in prison. And here's a guy that, even if you believe what he is in prison for, that it actually did happen, I mean, nobody was even harmed, and they just, I mean, they'll keep him in there for the rest of his life.
Yeah. One other thing that has happened throughout time that I think ties this into what's happening today in the country with Lawfare. One of the witnesses that testified on behalf of James Scott, saying that he was innocent, was a soil and atmospheric science professor from Mizzou, a guy named David Hammer. He's got about as impeccable credentials as you could have. He was a U.S. Naval Academy grad, combat marine in Vietnam, PhD and master's degrees from University of Tennessee and University of Illinois. He testified that there's no way one man broke this levy, that James Scott's 100% innocent. The prosecuting attorney submitted to the judge discrediting this expert, saying, well, he wasn't Johnny on the spot. This is all hearsay, even though Dr. Hammer published in scientific journals about the veracity of the science. And the Democratic judge appointed by Carnahan tossed it, wouldn't let his testimony in. So there's literally been nothing in the record on behalf of James Scott proving that this levy was in a process of imminent failure. It's a massive conspiracy, and I say that not lightheadedly, because as an independent journalist, I don't go into anything thinking there was a conspiracy, but it's proving itself out.
Well, and you noted when we began the interview, you started covering this as a journalist and not as a journalist who had some sort of interest because, well, this guy looks like he's being railroaded, so I'm going to cover this. You were just dispatched to cover it straight up as a journalist. Here's a case of interest. And so you did not go into it thinking, oh, well, here's some innocent guy being railroaded.
No, in fact, it was the opposite. I went into it assuming he was guilty because I was interviewing him in prison and he had already been convicted. Right. So no, there was no presumption of innocence. I'm like, this guy's, you know, he's a good, he has a life sentence, so he's exactly where he belongs. And then 25 years later, the case is completely exploded. It's blown up.
Our author of the week, Adam Pitluck. The book is Damned to Eternity. Final question, and then anything else at all that you've got that you want to share. People oftentimes they hear this sort of thing and they're like, well, you know, where are things now? What is there anything we can do? Is there a parole board? Is there a GoFundMe? Is there, you know, any sort of, you know, like pardon that can occur? Where do things stand now? Are there any avenues of hope here that this can be remedied?
That's a great question. Yes, there is hope now, for a glimmer of hope for the first time in decades. Working with a lawyer, we are working on getting in front of Governor Parson before he leaves office and presenting him with the evidence in this case to show that this is just a miscarriage of justice. So that's one avenue. Another avenue is, because there's all this evidence coming forward, we're actually looking into the jurisdiction. We don't think the state of Missouri ever should have brought this case or ever had the jurisdiction to. This is a federal case. I mean, this is the Mississippi River and a levee that's owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So we're looking at that. And then, of course, we have the impropriety of some of the people, the key players involved, that we're digging into their background pretty significantly right now to try to find more evidence. So there's definitely hope. There is a GoFundMe. There is a pro bono lawyer right now, but the GoFundMe is 100%. All proceeds go to his legal case and to him. I mean, he lives off of about $100 to $300 a year in donations just for his commissary. So you can find, just search for James Scott on GoFundMe and you'll find it. My name's on it as well. So there is hope, and you and other like-minded media personality committed to truth, justice, uncovering these miscarriages of justice, they're happening now with more frequency. So I am optimistic for the first time in over a decade that there's a light at the end of the tunnel here.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate you coming on, and it's somewhat of a non-traditional Author of the Week interview. As I mentioned, generally the books that we interview the authors are, it's relevant because the book was just published, and that not being the case here, but the interest of the case itself and the information you had to provide, and the fact that there is an attempt to get Parson to look at this, to get in front of him, hopefully to find someone that can help that happen so that he can review this and perhaps before he is no longer governor, do the right thing on this. And it's also part of the reason that we've held you on as long as we did. If there are any updates, then definitely keep us in the loop if you would. And as I said, some of those folks that you're talking about that are working on this as well, I believe we're working on getting them in studio to talk a little further about this. Adam Pitluck, the book Damned to Attorney. Appreciate you being with us this morning.
Nick, I appreciate you. Thank you very much. And thank you to your listeners.
All right. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. I'm Nick Reed.